Hello. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you to Thurber House for having me. I really appreciate the invitation, and as was mentioned in the introduction, it's very fitting for me to be here since I grew up here, and I've seen actually a lot of people that I know tonight, blast from the past, and I have family here and everything. And in addition, I actually have another connection to Thurber House, which is, my dad was telling me earlier, my grandfather, who's a graduate of Ohio State and also grew up in Columbus, Herbert Beyer, was a contemporary of James Thurber. They were classmates at Ohio State. He was a few years behind him. My grandfather was a few years behind James Thurber. And they worked on the literary magazine together, which is called The Sundial. And Thurber was the editor of it, and my grandfather worked under him. And then he eventually, my grandfather, a few years later, became editor of that same publication. And also was a journalist in the early part of his life. So I think he would be very pleased to know that I was standing here at Thurber House. And the other reason that this is fitting, and I didn't realize this at all after, it was long after we had scheduled this event, that I actually quote James Thurber in my book. At the very, very end, the final chapter, I quote from The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which is, of course, one of his most famous and beloved stories. And the reason that I quote from it is it's a story. It's obviously it's a funny story because it's James Thurber. It's very heartbreaking too because it's about a man who is trapped in his fantasies. He lives this very rich fantasy life, but he never really acts on any of them. And it's the thing that provides him escape is also sort of his prison. And I think it's a lot of people identify with the story because we all have longed to escape from our everyday lives from time to time, sometimes more than time to time. And that's definitely a theme of Sweet. Even though Sweet is about playing pool, it's also about my fantasy life and about how Sweet provided me an escape from my day-to-day life, how pool provided me an escape, learning to play pool and discovering this very dark and interesting subculture. But unlike Walter Mitty, it was very liberating for me, and it brought out a lot of qualities that had been long buried. So there was a transformation that Walter Mitty was unable to make, but that I was able to make. So that's definitely a difference. But I think that story resonates, Walter Mitty, even today, because it's so universal, these feelings. And it's funny, when my book first sold to a publisher, it was a proposal of about 75 pages, and then, of course, I had to write the thing. And I remember my literary agent saying to me, I wanted advice, and she said, well, you need to make it unique and universal. Gee, is that all? So, but I think that is, you know, sort of, it's why his story is so popular, and it's something that I did strive for, you know, taking this quirky thing of a young woman playing pool in the big city, but also trying to make it appeal to people so that someone who maybe had found a similar release in bluegrass music or golf or dancing or tiddlywinks or whatever could identify with it. And it's a memoir, so it is, even though it's written in novelistic fashion, it is my story. And there's so many memoirs out right now. I mean, if you look on the bestseller list or in the review pages of any publication, New York Times, local papers, it seems like that is the type of book of the mome. There are so many different, I feel there's like a lot of categories of memoir now. There's the, you know, the recovery memoir, there's the crazy dysfunctional family memoir, there's the degradation followed by redemption memoir, and there's the, you know, the personal journey memoir that often involves, you know, going to another country or taking up an activity such as pool. It's often written by women, maybe starts with a breakup, ends up, you know, with a romance, that kind of thing. So, and mine doesn't really fit neatly into any one of those categories, although it does have a few elements of some of them. But I would say mine would be the, you know, creating the alternate life or alternate persona memoir, having a secret life. So I'm going to introduce my own category of memoir to the marketplace, and I'll call it the Walter Mitty type memoir. I thought that I would, I'm going to read two short sections from the book, and I thought I would read one that is set in Columbus and set in my youth here, just because of the hometown audience. So I will start with that, And then I will set the scene for the second section, which is quite different and set in the gritty pool environs of New York City. So I will begin. Although it is New York City and the silent, soothing tableau of Asian men playing snooker that beckon me into my first pool hall, my attraction to this peculiar drama goes back a long way, to the baseball diamonds of my youth, both the backyard variety and the ones on my television screen. I'm young when the romance starts, 5 years old at the most, and who can blame me? It's the 1970s, a time of weird mustaches, crazy sideburns, and giant afros, baseball caps perched precariously on top of them, looking small and jaunty, like paper umbrellas and fancy drinks. It's learning funny and exciting words. Spitball, knuckleball, shortstop, balk, foul tip, grand slam, the windup, stolen base. It's baseball. It's Cincinnati Reds baseball, and I'm in love. My unbridled passion is not for the game's grand tradition or eccentric rules, however. That will come later. No, I'm in love with a player. I'm in love with Johnny Bench. Not in love. I'm too young for that. But in love the way that kids who are taken with something or someone are filled first with awe and then with utter devotion. I live in Columbus, 2 hours north of Cincinnati, and I'm 7 years old when I see my first game in person at Riverfront Stadium. The Reds are playing the Philadelphia Phillies. We sit far from the field near the bleachers so that the players seem like ants to me, zipping around on a green and brown lawn. The game lasts 15 innings until Ken Griffey, who at the time was not yet known as Ken Griffey Sr., breaks the tie with a solo home run. I watch baseball, guided by my dad and my older brother Andrew, on the big square RCA television in our family room. I understand home runs immediately, as most kids do, but I also quickly comprehend singles, doubles, and the ever-rare triple. I love gravity-defying catches in the outfield, the fielders stretching across the wall like unfurled flags. I love the acrobatics of the shortstop, the graceful and underrated Dave Concepcion. And I'm thrilled at the delicious prospect of a stolen base. Joe Morgan, Little Joe, as my dad and the whole country calls him, never lets me down. But I quickly deduce that something else is at work underneath this obvious drama. My brother and father are always talking about certain plays and pointing to the screen. If he's smart, he'll bunt. Think he'll go for the hit and run? I ask questions, and concepts are explained to me, most of the time to my satisfaction. I learn the rules. I learn that managers have strategies, that they perform other tasks besides screaming at umpires. My dad teaches me how to read box scores, and this is before the newspapers did all the math for you. The early box score reader had to figure out for herself how many games behind or ahead a team was. It was a great way to learn fractions. In my opinion, there cannot be a better team from which to learn the perplexing, addictive minutiae of baseball than the Reds of the 1970s. And always, there is Johnny. Johnny Bench is special. He wears glumpy equipment that makes him look like a crab scrunched up behind home plate. He squats down, his face invisible behind a dangerous-looking mask. He gets to trot out to the mound and talk with the pitcher. He gets to bean balls to second base, throwing right at the pitcher, or so it seems, and save that base from the likes of Lou Brock and Davey Lopes. He sees the whole field spread out in front of him, the only player besides the batter with that perspective. He knows weird sign language, which he uses to communicate with the pitcher, their own secret code through which they choose what pitch to use. He acts like the boss, directs the game, seems to know great secrets. He gets to wear his hat backward. He gets to slide his mask up to his forehead and peer out during breaks in the game, his large round glove hanging like a giant paw at his side, a lion taking a breather before pouncing again. In short, he stands out, and he has a great name, Johnny Bench, a name both carefree and sturdy. And although I am fascinated by his defensive work, I'd be lying if I didn't admit that what I really love is how he hits home runs. And for a brief period, I actually think I have something to do with them. When Bench, number 5, comes up to the plate, if I'm not nearby, a rarity, my dad or my brother will call out to me that Bench is up, and I come streaking into the room, flushed with excitement and fear. I watch him crouch there, looking completely different without all of his bulky gear, and sometimes I just can't take the tension. I mutter that I want him to hit a home run, even if my dad says, all we need is a single here. And one day, I announce that it's all too much. I just can't take it anymore. I'm going to watch from inside the closet. No one pays much attention to me as I slip into the grown-up's coat closet. Our snowsuits and windbreakers and rubber boots are crammed into the kids' closet, which is on the other side of the utility closet. These important closets line the family room, the most used room in our two-story aluminum-sided house on Stanwood Road. The closets all have louver doors. I don't know what a louver is, but the important thing is that the doors have slats and you can peek through them, a distinct advantage when hiding or when praying for a home run. So I crouch in the closet among the leather boots and umbrellas, draped in my mother's soft, sweet-smelling coats. By ducking my head at a certain angle, I'm able to find the right slat to peer through so I can still see the TV. I poke my fingers through the slats and hold on. I don't make a sound. And then, after a few foul tips and a few balls, Johnny cracks one over the wall. Much commotion on the couch for my dad and my brother. Heather, get in here. Bench hit a home run. Andy, where's your sister? She's in the closet. What? What is she doing in there? And at this point, I fling open the door and leap out screaming, I can't believe it, I can't believe it, and jump up and down. Johnny has come through. That I've witnessed this home run from inside a closet amuses everyone, including me. The next time Johnny comes to the plate, my dad suggests I go into the closet again, and I happily oblige. Johnny Bench hits a double into the left corner. So for a while, depending on the situation, it must be a tense one where the Reds really need a run, I retreat into the closet whenever Johnny Bench is at bat. Heather, get in the closet. Do your stuff, my dad commands, and I obey. My percentage turns out to be pretty good. More often than you'd expect, I leap from the closet in triumph, in time to see Bench rounding the bases. We all seem to believe that I have some mystical connection to the man, that somehow I am causing his home runs, or at least contributing in some small but meaningful way. This leads to another discovery. I begin to sense at age 7 or 8 that glorious power hits are not random. They can be anticipated, even planned. There are different pitches that go with them, different situations that call for them. Players don't just amble to the plate and hope for the best, banging away at any ball in their path. I'm not 100% sure how all this works, but in the solipsistic way of little kids, by placing myself in the center of the drama, I begin to intuit the elegance and intelligence of this game. As fun as it is for me to imagine, deep down, I know I'm not pulling Johnny Bench's strings or anyone else's strings. He's doing it himself. My fascination with catchers and my fixation on Johnny Bench only intensify. I am no longer satisfied with being sidelined, mute, and in awe. I want to play. So my dad and my brother and I play wiffle ball on the weekends with the familiar yellow plastic bat and the white ball with holes in it. We set up a makeshift stadium in our backyard, but soon it becomes too easy. When I'm 10, I am finally old enough to join a summer softball league for girls. I arrive for the first practice somewhat shy. The other girls are huge. I'm small for my age, a tiny kid with long dark hair and big eyes whose years steering the big red machine from a coat closet evaporate the minute the tallest girl in my class, the slow-eyed and inscrutable Jennifer Fate, whizzes a ball past my ear into the waiting glove of Stacy Goodall, who has a boy's haircut and is built like a truck, thick and broad-shouldered, even her teeth are big, and who ignores me, even though I know more about baseball than she does. These girls are athletes. They are tomboys, tan and taciturn, with complicated athletic shoes. They wear baseball caps year-round. At the other end of the spectrum resides a group of bored girls who've been forced by their parents to join the team as a summer activity. They're irritated at having to show up twice a week and play in the thick, humid air under a blazing Midwestern sun. Worse, some of these bored, blonde, ponytailed girls are natural athletes. They move with grace, catch on early during our drills, mechanically throw the ball in perfect arcs, and scoop up grounders with ease while rolling their eyes. I have some grace, too, I suppose, and I am brilliantly fast, but my throwing arm is pathetic. Instead of shot putting across the field toward a stunned, wide-eyed 10-year-old, like the balls thrown by Jennifer Fate, my balls flail in the air, straining for a distance that is never achieved, then dribble morosely to the ground, finally rolling into the glove of my throwing partner, who squats down, neither stunned nor wide-eyed, just wilted from standing in the heat for so long. Occasionally, the balls I throw soar up, and then fall straight back down with a soft thud. Heather, we're throwing overhand, Miss Holloway, our mannish, unsmiling coach, calls out to me, her voice tinged with exasperation. I am throwing it overhand, I call back. Does she think I'm an idiot? I know how to throw a ball. I'm just terrible at it. My fielding is only marginally better than my throwing. I run over ground balls and have to run back for them. I flinch at line drives, and in the outfield, while charging toward one of the few balls ever hit out there, I extend my arm, glove upturned, eager, only to watch the ball plop down about a foot in front of me, where I scramble to grab it and hurl it back into our practice game, watching it bounce 20 times before reaching the disgusted girl on third base. Despite my awkward, confused athletic style, there is one thing I can do. I hit. I've imitated the batting stances of enough Reds in my backyard to know how to hold a bat firmly, to bear down but not choke up. I swing hard and all the way around, flinging my bat to the side and taking off the second I make contact. I'm surprisingly powerful for being just a slip of a thing, and while I never hit anything truly momentous in practice, I am one of the few who regularly makes contact with the ball. One day, as our first game nears, Miss Holloway gathers us into a circle, the ground hot and brown beneath our feet, the sky overhead an unflinching blue. A lawnmower buzzes in the background, the eternal sound of an Ohio summer. Miss Holloway tells us it's time to pick positions and get our jerseys. It isn't very scientific. Who wants to play first base? Little hands shoot up like spears. When she gets to, who wants to be catcher? No hands rise in the air, which surprises me. I guess it must seem a boring position. You just squat behind the plate, fielding easy balls and tossing them back to the pitcher's mound. There's no glamour. I raise my hand. Miss Holloway looks at me in disbelief, no doubt thinking about how often I shrink from the balls in practice. It wasn't fear. It was pure mortification. Heather, you want to be catcher? Yeah, I'll do it. Are you sure? She eyes my 62-pound frame, my two long braids, my little sneakers covered in dust. Jennifer's going to pitch. Do you really want to catch all of those balls? She's probably worried I'll be knocked flat after the first strike and there'll be a lawsuit. I want to do it, I say. I'm a hitter, and catchers are hitters. Johnny Bench is both a catcher and a hitter. In my mind, there is no room for discussion. Okay, she says, smiling for a change. Our jerseys, oversized T-shirts that say Bexley Recreation on the front, are red. Red! And we wear matching red baseball caps. The following week is our first game. My parents, grandparents, and brother are all there, as are the families of the other players, sitting either in the narrow bleachers that have been set up or on lawn chairs they've brought from home. I'm nervous, my stomach fluttery. I'm using an old baseball glove of my brother's that looks ridiculous over my small hand. We're the home team, playing a bunch of girls dressed in royal blue. The game starts at 1 sharp, the sky a warm, milky blue, coated with sunlight. I squat behind the plate, dropping most of Jennifer's pitches, but not in an embarrassing way. It isn't nearly the disaster Miss Holloway has anticipated. Soon it's our turn to bat. I'm third in the batting order. When I get to the batting circle, no one has made it safely to a base yet. The first couple of pitches are terrible, and I watch unblinking as they fall off to the side, nowhere near the plate. Then I swing at one that's reasonably close and miss. I notice the royal blue girls inch forward. This makes me angry. Oh yeah, I think, digging my feet into the dirt. What have you done up here? And then, while waiting for the girl on the mound to scratch her nose and pull on her shorts and wind up for her next pitch, I have what can only be described as a vision. I see just where I want to put the ball. In fact, for a split second, I can see the rest of the game stretch out in front of me, see myself swinging, running, moving. I crouch down, stare hard at the girl facing me, who looks like she'd rather be at home watching TV. And when the pitch comes, I swing long and full and hear the sound, that sound, the crack of bat hitting ball, and feel it all the way through my arms, from my fingertips to my shoulders, and hear a gasp from the crowd and see, just for a second, the ball arc up and out, disappearing as it sails over the sea of blue baseball caps. Someone cheers. I fling the bat and run, my arms pumping, my head down, thrilled and terrified, running as fast as I can, a streak of red. I can hear people yelling. I run so hard and so fast and with such determination that when I finally turn in a graceful curve so I can take what I'm sure will be 2 more bases, this is at least a triple, it takes me a moment to realize that people are no longer screaming at my hit. They are screaming at me, calling my name, gesturing wildly. I search for second base and finally stop where I think it is. Only then do I realize I'm in the outfield. I have run so hard and with such joy and gusto after my bat cracked that ball that I've shot past first base and then arced so wide when I made my turn toward second that I am now in center field. The ball, which has landed somewhere far away and has been bobbled about by the frantic girls on the blue team, is making its way toward the infield. My team shrieks at me to go to second base, but I can't find it. My eyes rake the field and finally spot the base about 20 feet in front of me, just as the other team's third baseman is lobbing the ball to second. It's a race against time. I run toward the bag, but the ball gets there first. It bounces once. The girl grabs it and holds it out as I charge to her, tagging me and screaming, "You're out!" And I am. I hit the longest ball anyone on our team has ever or will ever hit, and I got lost on the way to second base. There is a loud, oh, of disappointment as I walk dejectedly to our bench, my face burning. I can't meet the eyes of my teammates. My brother, normally mild-tempered and encouraging, leaps from the bleachers and runs up to me shouting, "What were you doing? Are you blind?" From somewhere that sounds very far away, I hear my dad say, "Leave her alone." My brother stalks off. I sit down on the bench. The incident does not leave terrible scars on my psyche, though it certainly lingers for a bit. I blame myself cleanly and want only to learn how to not make the same blunder again. I am not turned off from baseball or from catching or from my beloved Reds. Quite the contrary, I am thrilled that I gleaned something from staring through those louvered doors, that when I was standing at the plate in that one glorious moment, I knew ahead of time where I wanted to put that ball and just how hard I needed to hit it to get it there. It wasn't random. But this is not my only epiphany that summer. I begin to consider the possibility that I might never improve as a player, at least not enough to earn the prominent place on a softball team that I'd hoped for. My love of the game is not enough. It will never be enough. It will never, for example, give me a throwing arm. I am not the second coming of Johnny Bench. I am a kid who will decide to take a pottery class the following summer. I make a beautiful glazed turtle that sits on a bookshelf for years, gazing solemnly at our family room from its perch in front of hardcover copies of All the President's Men and The Making of the President, 1968. The class is not anywhere near as exciting as hitting a ball or flipping my hat backward in my role as catcher. But I excel, which is, it turns out, more important to me than pure excitement. I don't know yet what a burden this will prove to be. I don't start playing pool for another 21 years, but many of the elements that make pool, at least inside my head, such a natural fit for me, are the same ones that made baseball seem like such a natural fit all those years ago. Like baseball, pool is deceptively complex. It's a game with no clock carved into innings, units of time that can stretch into the next day if necessary. And both games are often determined by millimeters. By this, I mean that how a pool player strokes a ball, or where exactly the pitcher throws one over the plate, can determine an entire game. Batters, like pool players, hit with an idea in their minds, a plan they are trying to execute. Fielders try to anticipate this plan. Sometimes it unfolds like a stage play with exits and entrances marked. But sometimes, if a swing is just a little off, if the pitch goes slightly farther than it was supposed to, everything is altered and you have to improvise. The quicker you are at improvisation, the better baseball player you will be. This same art applies to pool. You could argue that chance, and the creativity that accompanies it, is a facet of all sports, but I'm not sure I believe this. In baseball and in pool, this room for creativity has to do with the speed, or rather the lack of it, in the game. You have room. You have time. Judgments are made, then rethought again. I believe that these games are not about physics, despite the diagrams you might find in instruction manuals. They are about executing and adjusting in small increments and remembering certain situations and how to get out of them. If you've got a good memory, and I do, both games can provide hours of fun and torture. But although the elemental connection is there, after I am no longer simply watching pool, hypnotized from a distance by its complex geometry and quiet beauty, and begin to play it, some of the connections to baseball, the game of my heart and my youth, start to crumble until they disappear altogether as if they've never been there at all. Which is the bittersweet transformation that occurs when you make something your own. So that chapter, or that's a part of a chapter, sort of draws a portrait of my very first experience on a team of any sort. And then, of course, many years later in New York City, after learning to play pool at a pool hall in Manhattan, I got coaxed into joining a pool team there. So this chapter is about 100 pages into the book. And all you really need to know is that I play in a pool league. So when I refer to the league, it's the American Pool Players Association, which is a national league. I'm sure there are chapters in Columbus. There are 8 players on a team. 5 of these players are chosen to play when there's a match, which usually plays once a week. They're usually Monday teams, Tuesday teams, something like that. And they play out of a bar. Home matches are at your home tavern, and away matches, you visit other bars. So there is the alcohol element in addition to playing pool. And I think that is all you will really need to know to the rest of the chapter. It kind of stands on its own. This is why I chose it. It's sort of a microcosm of the book and a good contrast, I think, to what I just read. So this is chapter 9, which I call A Painful Case. With Roger struggling so hard to keep his life buoyant and carefree, to stave off his sense of doom, it makes sense, I suppose, that there would be, on the other side of the hill, a person who's always kicking rocks and dirt down the slope, the intense, angry counterpart to Roger. This role on our pool team is played with great passion by Trevor, who, when he starts showing up regularly again, rips a hole in the fabric that Roger has been trying each week to keep stitched together. Trevor is magnetic, brooding, sexy, unrestrained. Women watch him when he walks down the street, their covert gazes a mixture of admiration and fear. He inspires both in people. He acts like someone who is meant for more, and he was, I think, a long time ago in a different life. Listen to this. You have to listen to this. It's Roger calling me at work, something he's taken to doing once or twice a week. He wants me to hear a message left on his cell phone. It's from Trevor, who, like Roger, is one of the original members of the team. He's been on it since Paul G. assembled it a few years ago. His attendance is sporadic. Trevor disappears and reappears with no warning or explanation. No one seems to mind. Such behavior is hardly uncommon in our pool league, even if Trevor is the only person on our team to exhibit it. Roger gives me his access code and tells me to call his cell phone. Trevor's message is there, rambling but not wholly incoherent for those who know him. He's upset with Roger's being part of the system. It's a familiar rant, and I've been on the team for only 3 months. I can't imagine listening to it for 3 years. Okay, first of all, don't try to put any of your slick lawyer moves on me. You hate yourself, man, but that's not my problem. I've made sacrifices, and yeah, maybe my life hasn't worked out so great, but I can't even imagine being you, okay? That's number one. And also, I don't need you to settle my arguments, and when I want to, I can play better than anyone on this team, anyone. And I just feel sorry for you, man. Don't you condescend to me or think you can... You can't buy me. I don't need your money. You like to think you're Mr. Nice Guy and want everyone else to think you're Mr. Nice Guy. But I know the truth. And you know, I mean, the hell with this. I don't need this BS. I don't need this team. I don't need your money or your attitude or your money or any of this. I've got my art, and I am true to myself, and I don't need anyone to tell me how to live my life. And I'll make my own decisions and play the way I want to play. And don't interfere. And I mean, it's just over. I don't want you in my life. Do you hear me? You represent everything about the system I hate. I feel sorry for you, man. You can just keep your stupid money. It's all you care about. Freaking lawyer. You... And then, finally, mercifully, the message is cut off. The real issue, which reared its head during the team's most recent pool match, is that once again, Trevor has no place to live. He hasn't had a construction job in a few weeks. He has no money and an unquenchable thirst for whiskey, right out of a James Joyce short story. Roger gives him a couple $100s in the hope that Trevor can bribe some friend of a friend into letting him crash on his floor. Shelley, Roger's girlfriend, tells Roger no way can Trevor stay at their place, not even for one night. So Trevor accepts the money, he always does, but then proceeds to start a fight with his next pool opponent, some meek, oblivious guy from a meek, oblivious team, which then metamorphoses into picking a fight with Roger, who is the person he's wanted to fight with all along. Roger bails him out all the time, and Trevor leaves insane messages for people constantly, not just for Roger, for others as well. But this particular one seems to carry more venom, delusion, and desperation than usual. It gets to Roger, enough that he saves it, and now he needs me to listen to it. What can I say? Trevor's an unhappy guy, Roger. I mean, you have to dismiss all of this. But where does this come from? What the heck did I do? I'm nothing but nice to this guy all the time. I think that's part of the problem, Raj. I think your generosity makes him feel terrible. He needs you, but you remind him of everything that's wrong with his life, everything he can't do, and how he can't be similarly generous to people. It doesn't excuse that ridiculous, crazy message, which was mean and unnecessary, but it sort of explains it, you know? Yeah, I know. There is almost constant friction between Roger and Trevor these days, instigated entirely by Trevor. He's a contradiction, because despite his role as instigator, he's also dashing and handsome and can actually be quite charming at times. He reads a lot, follows politics, tells entertaining stories, and carries around his headshots as if maybe some casting director will stop him on the street. He thinks of himself as a director, playwright, actor, producer, but I've yet to hear about anything theatrical he's been involved in other than renovating a theater in New Jersey. And, of course, the daily drama of his own life. Trevor likes to stare at people to make them feel uncomfortable. He hits on women with a decent level of success. He says to me one night, after I've been on the team for 2 weeks, lowering his eyelids seductively, tucking a curl behind his ear, and rubbing his sexy, sandpapery stubble, I want to be your lover. He's completely serious. I'm so flabbergasted I have no response at first. I'm just putting it out there, he adds. Then, stating the obvious, what can I say? I'm direct. I politely decline his offer, which I find myself doing repeatedly, though I can't say the solicitations offend me. Trevor's hair is soft and lush, an inviting thicket that wafts romantically behind his ears when the wind blows, as if he's some swashbuckling hero from the 18th century. He has deep brown eyes framed by long lashes that curl up at the tips, but the sensitive features stop there. His face is tough, Irish, unforgiving, his neck thick. Years of construction work have helped cultivate rippling muscles that he shows off in tank tops and ripped t-shirts. He's a dark, compelling character, but I enter his life at the tail end of its unraveling. I never knew Trevor when he was the exuberant, fast-talking ad man full of promise, with a young family and a golden life in some other part of the country. Trevor's from Texas, though his twang has been smoothed over the years into a deep, husky purr. He never speaks of his family there. No one knows if there are any siblings or grandparents or cousins, or even parents for that matter. It's as if he emerged fully formed from the piney woods, where he walked straight to the nearest baseball diamond and hit a ball so far that it was rumored to have landed in a parking lot in Arkansas. He's a glorious athlete, football, cross-country, basketball, but baseball is his true gift. He has major league scouts looking at him when he's a teenager, and eventually a small southern college gives him a 4-year scholarship in exchange for consistently dazzling his coaches on the field, until he messes up his knee, twists it cruelly during some gravity-defying dive into a fence or a base or home plate, the story tends to change, and spends his final year on the bench, his knee now crisscrossed with surgical scars, his temper stretched to the breaking point as scouts come to watch the newest crop of Jesuses to emerge fully formed from the piney woods somewhere, with free rides of their own. So Trevor leaves the sleepy South in a rage, determined to change his luck, to be the golden boy again. He ends up in a big Midwestern city where he talks his way into an ad agency and a year later is running a whole division. He earns a huge salary, gets invited to parties at the boss's house, which has a swimming pool and a gazebo, meets a beautiful woman from a wealthy, prominent family, and he marries her. They soon have a son. His life is perfect. The only trace of the raw deal he still sometimes feels he's gotten is the scars that are now fading to a soft, bumpy pink on his leg. But here's where the story gets confusing, because something goes terribly awry with Trevor, and it's hard to figure out exactly when it happened or why, but it certainly can't be blamed solely on the premature end of his baseball career. First, he gets fired, not laid off because of budgetary reasons, but escorted to the door by a hulking security guard for much darker ones. He says it's because he looks out for his people, not himself, that he won't lie to them, won't capitulate to the man. Then his marriage ends badly, and his wife's influential family gets involved, and it's ugly and public, and he loses all privileges regarding his son. He isn't even granted visitation rights, again, because of some conspiracy that's been designed to undermine his strong will, his streak of iconoclasm. Trevor makes it seem as if he's been run out of town by the sheriff. He comes to New York to reinvent himself and becomes hell-bent on expressing his peculiar, angry, self-serving vision of the world in the theater. He will be an actor. He's certainly charismatic enough, and he will finally explain it all. He will rehabilitate his tarnished image, and his genius will be revealed. But except for the headshots and building a few stage sets, that hasn't happened. It's been 5 years since he came to the city, 5 years since he's seen or talked to his son or his family. He writes letters to his son, who's 8 years old now, he says, but he suspects they're never given to the boy. They're probably intercepted and most likely burned. He runs out of money and loses his apartment. He's able to get sporadic construction work, and through his web of offbeat friends and the women who've fallen under his spell, he's managed to find floors to crash on and beds to sleep in for almost a year. He has some books and some clothes and a beautiful pool cue, which he brings with him to each new tenement. He drinks and he picks fights and he plays pool and he seems to take up for every fired bartender or kicked out band member in town. He is for the downtrodden, always. He's also now 38 years old. And if it wasn't for Roger buying his drinks and slipping him a couple $100s when he's between construction gigs, I really think Trevor would be sleeping on the street. He's not without grace. I see flashes of the man he once was, we all do, and they usually appear, fleetingly but memorably, during a game of pool. Trevor's a good pool player who is occasionally brilliant. He can come up with tournament-level moves when he wants to. But his play is so erratic and so dependent on his mood and the amount of alcohol in his system that his league rank, he's a 4, will probably never go up. He's stuck in pool just as he's stuck in every other aspect of his life. But somehow he doesn't see this as his fault. Rather, it's the fault of the world for misunderstanding him. He brings to my mind a line from The Hustler, when George C. Scott, playing the role of sinister stake horse Burt Gordon, says to Fast Eddie Felsen, "All you gotta do is learn to feel sorry for yourself. It's one of the best indoor sports, feeling sorry for yourself. Sport enjoyed by all, especially the born losers." Eddie sets out to prove Burt wrong, but in the end, though he returns and beats Minnesota Fats, there's something sad and pyrrhic about his victory. A similar pall falls over Trevor's games. His expertly crafted wins, when they occur, provide only a flicker of pleasure. They seem merely to remind him of everything else he's lost. What do I have in common with a tormented guy like Trevor? Or guys like Paul G. and Gary? Why do I desire, at age 32, to surround myself with human wrecks who exhibit occasional bursts of beauty? As I get to know them, the pool players I meet strike me the same way the East Village strikes me, as a contradictory presence. They appear to need no one, and yet also seem unbearably lonely. When I think of my own loneliness, my feeling out of place in the jabbering, fast-paced New York circle I'm in, I realize how private it feels, how embarrassing. I also realize, after I join Paul G's pool team, that what I feel when I play alongside someone like Trevor is a strange kind of kinship. I revel in this unspoken solidarity while I'm with my dark-souled teammates, but I leave it at the door on my way out, using it, and if I'm honest, using them, to fortify myself. This is why I don't find myself leaving anguished messages on people's cell phones. There is no question that for Paul G and Gary and Trevor, pool and where it is played serves a much more vital purpose than just recreation. Pool bars function as their offices, as their relationships, as their connections to the world or their buffers from it. This is an entirely new landscape for me, both physically, dark and small and cramped and dangerous, and psychologically, also dark and small and cramped and dangerous. That landscape can change quickly, which is the other magnet that draws me to pool and to the lives of pool players. Every Monday, when I enter a bar with a pool table in the back, my teammates sprawled on bar stools or slouching near the rack of cues, Liz raising an eyebrow and giving me a nod and a smile as I make my way toward the inner sanctum, feeling just a little superior as I pass the non-pool-playing patrons. I feel a sense of anticipation, a tingling apprehension. Anything can happen tonight, anything. Is this the real appeal? Do I secretly want to step into my own downward spiral, sleep with rough trade, become an unwitting participant in shady drug deals, learn how to hustle and cheat and identify marks, make strange late-night phone calls from payphones to mysterious friends in far-flung places, live my own Elizabeth Wurtzel, tragi-chic, dysfunctional existence until a kindly therapist who bears an uncanny resemblance to Robin Williams or Whoopi Goldberg pulls me out of it? No, I don't think so. I am not an adrenaline junkie, nor do I have a particular desire to associate with bad characters. But the distance between fear and joy is, not surprisingly, quite short, and the journey from one to the other is, more often than not, quite thrilling, no matter which direction you're heading. Melissa Holbrook Pearson addresses this sensation in her intelligent, passionate, and eccentric book, The Perfect Vehicle: What It Is About Motorcycles. The risks associated with motorcycle riding are obvious and real. One mistake, one wobbly turn, or one slick, badly lit road can cost you your life, or at least your limbs. In trying to present for non-riders the reasons that sane human beings find themselves caught up with these machines, Pearson tries to break down the components of danger, of risk. She starts by addressing the work of Michael Apter, who wrote Dangerous Edge: The Psychology of Excitement. He points out that anxiety and excitement produce the same physiological response. The chemicals that course through us when we are faced with these emotions make us either want to run from the cause or embrace and enjoy it, depending on the situation. The application to motorcycle riding is obvious. The application to my frequenting pool establishments is no less so, I think. The pull for me is not the scruffiness of certain players or the hair-trigger aspect of certain situations, though on occasion both qualities contribute to my anxiety and excitement levels. Rather, it's the rush of being able to emerge from a dark corner, both literally and metaphorically, and live inside this elegant, sexy, often maddening game, this strange subterranean world where my background is meaningless, my voice, even my posture is different, to stand front and center, forced to draw from another part of myself, a part that's less sure but perhaps more interesting. to feed off the smoke and music and amber bottles, the growling guys in sinister boots, hell, the growling women in sinister boots, and to stay focused, to prevail, to shut out everything except this one moment at a pool table. It may not be the same as having a throttle in my hand, as having wind in my hair as I take a turn moving at heart-pumping speeds, but it's darn close. Pearson writes that motorcycles can red flag fear, call it out from its dark hiding place. They let us shadow box with it, then give it the old cathartic heave-ho. That's what it's like on Mondays at the bar. That's the appeal of danger and the appeal to me of pool. It calls out my fear, then kicks its butt. Sometimes, though, I get kicked back. Thank you.